The verdict is out. The sexual revolution didn't work. And much of what was pushed and is pushed in the sexual revolution, the average guy doesn't want, which means that it's coming very much top down. Guys, we're going to unmask all this and more importantly, help you navigate it today on The Chris Stefanik Show. Welcome to The Chris Stefanik Show. We're here every week to give you the tools and inspiration you need to live your everyday life with joy. If you want daily inspiration, click below this video. Be one of the many people who sign up for the Daily Anchor. We got your back. We want to inspire you to live life to the full, no strings attached. Missionaries of Joy, thank you guys. It's because of you that we're able to do this and all the work that we do to spread the kingdom of God and serve people in need. Sign up to be a missionary of joy. Get off the sidelines. Help us out. It's a link below the video. And this episode is sponsored in part by EWTN. You can catch this and so much more on EWTN Plus streaming. Link is below the video. Oh, I don't want to get this right. This is an impressive bio. Former Yale and George Mason professor with a PhD in economics, Jennifer Robeck Morris founded the Ruth Institute to equip people, that's you, to stand for marriage, family, and truth. And not just to equip people to stand for those things, but to free people from lies. Because you got the wrong information, your life goes the wrong direction. In a culture that's increasingly confused, that's the word for it. She's a global speaker, author of 6 books, all of which we will link to below this video, including one we're going to be talking about today, The Sexual State. She apparently likes to poke the bear. We're going to poke the bear today. She's a leading voice exposing the human cost of the sexual revolution. And this isn't just an issue for culture warriors. This is real human cost. There's real pain. More than a scholar, I've picked up on this within the moment she walked into my office. She's a warm, beautiful, loving person. She's a mom, a wife, adoptive and biological, former foster parent to 8 children, and as of how long ago, Grandma?
About a month.
1 month, Grandma. High five. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah. I love being a grandparent, man. It is the best thing ever. I told my kids if I knew it would be this good, I'd have skipped you and gone straight to the grandkids. But every revolution, every social upheaval that we could look at in the past few hundred years, it started with the desire for something good, right? The French Revolution was addressing real injustice. And that was kind of used as a cover for the people who wanted to just deconstruct everything.
Mm-hmm.
To where if you said, hey, wait, maybe we shouldn't decapitate our neighbors in the streets to everyone's applause. The response was, wait, don't you want fraternity, equity, and justice? Don't you want those things? The sexual revolution is no different.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, that's exactly right. It's funny that you mentioned the French Revolution because
thinks is good.
It's kind of most Catholics don't think it's good, right? Because you can see past the liberty, equality, fraternity. Every one of those words has a proper Christian meaning, a proper, correct Catholic meaning that is doable. But what they were trying to do was to say equality at all costs, fraternity at all costs, right? Liberty at all costs. Well, all three of those things, liberty, fraternity, equality, have spun off their own ideologies that are also destructive, right? Because if you have one thing that you're doing at all costs, first of all, you can't do it. It's not possible. And because it's not possible, but you're telling everybody, oh, we must have equality. This is a big one for us today. Mm. We must have equality. We must have equality. Everybody must be equal. But wait a minute. Equal how? Equal in what? With respect to what?
Yeah,
in what dimension? In what dimension? Because you can't make everybody equal in every way. So they generally leave that off, exactly what they're planning, right? Mm. But if you get everybody hyped up and on steroids and on caffeine or whatever metaphor you want to use, if you get everybody all hyped up, to say this is so important, we're going to sacrifice everything for it, what you've basically just done is to say we're going to do the impossible and we have a blank check to do the impossible. And that's how it turns into a totalitarian movement, And so the sexual revolution,
that's when violence is required.
Yeah, violence becomes required. It takes a lot of power. It's an unlimited desire for power.
Yeah.
And all these revolutions, whether you're looking at the Bolsheviks or the French or whatever, or the sexual revolution, that, you know, there are true believers who are really in it, in a what's the right word? They're acting in good faith. Mm-hmm. They might be naive, but they are at least acting good in good faith. But you end up attracting people who are not acting in good faith, who see the power potential and get involved in it for that reason. And so
What good were they going for?
Oh, in which?
In the start of the sexual revolution.
The start of the sexual revolution. Well, I'm the wrong person to ask about that because I kind of think people were not acting in completely good faith from the very beginning. Mm. But I can tell you what they sold.
The average person going along with
I can tell you what they sold. Okay,
yeah,
I can tell you what they sold. They were selling fun and freedom. Hmm. You know, they were saying the old taboos are not really necessary. That was all being imposed on us by but it was being actually when you strip back the veil, it was always those Catholics, the Catholic Church. You know, when it get down to brass tacks, Catholic teaching is too oppressive. It's unnecessary. Those taboos are harming us. And what the promise of the sexual revolution was of freedom to do whatever you want sexually with the implied promise that nothing bad will ever happen to you. Nothing bad will ever happen, you see. Now, I never blurted out just quite like that because that's obvious that doesn't work, right? But that's what they were hinting at all along. And so if you want to go back to go back to Alfred Kinsey, you go back to Wilhelm Reich, those type of people, some of them had a kind of Freudian thing going on that if you are repressing your sexual desires, that this is bad, you know, this will make you neurotic, it will make you crazy in various ways. Although I'm not clear that Freud himself actually thought that. You know, but because I think Freud saw that there was some benefit to sexual restraint socially, you know, he saw that. But some of his followers, like Wilhelm Reich, you know, he was basically, you know, the cause of fascism is repressed sexuality. I mean, this was his theory.
Wow.
Yeah, and he's the guy who actually wrote a book called The Sexual Revolution, right?
Wow.
So this is the mentality that a lot of these guys are starting with. And then each step, interestingly enough, each step, each phase of the sexual revolution has a promise that all we're doing is we're just changing this one little thing. How can you object? You know, and then every single one of them turns out to be a much bigger deal than anybody ever expected. And maybe some of the people knew, but, you know, it was presented to us as harmless, basically.
And kind of rooted in an anthropology, a view of who we are and what we are that's totally counter to a broader, more holistic understanding of a person that kind of it would reduce us to sexual beings, right?
100%.
So
100%,
therefore,
Chris. Yeah, 100%.
Therefore, parameters are unimaginably cruel.
Right.
Because then we can't be who we are.
We can't be. And see, in the 1930s, you didn't have quote-unquote reliable birth control.
Mm.
But now people think we have reliable birth control, and so none of those rules matter. Mm. You know what I mean? They've mentally sterilized the sexual act. Mm. You know, in our minds, we're entitled to act as if every sexual act is sterile. And if you happen to have quirky lifestyle preferences and you want to have a child, well, you can do that. Maybe one, maybe two. Don't do anything crazy, like have five or something, you know.
Right. But six.
Yeah, don't do anything crazy, you know. But you know, basically, we're all entitled to view our sex lives as being essentially normally and normatively sterile, you know. Mm. And even in the 30s, that's where people wanted to go. But they didn't have reliable enough birth control. But the birth control campaigners is who I'm talking about. I'm talking about Margaret Sanger and the eugenics people that were hanging around with her, you know. And so a lot of pro-life people are aware that the birth control movement was originally a eugenics movement. Mm-hmm. Not everybody else knows that.
They weren't. Most don't know right now. Actually, expose that for us.
What do you want?
That's literally eugenics movement. Most people have no idea. Like, they've heard that and think, this is a radical, wait, this lady, come on, conspiracy theory. let's go there.
Well,
this is
my book. You have my book there. So there's a, in my, first, actually, before we do that, let me just say, here's how I define the sexual revolution. Because people use this term very, you know, however they want, you could say. And if you want to, I can explain how I came up with this three-part division.
And we'll, you know, we'll pause the eugenics and go back there.
We'll work our way up. Eugenics is an important piece of the puzzle, for sure. So I define that the sexual revolution as having three components, and the book is based on the three components. You know, it's organized in that manner, because this is important for people to understand. Because a lot of times people feel like they're being bombarded from every side, from with one crazy thing after another. But if you can see that there's really only three big ideas, then it's a little more manageable.
It helps,
right? Then there's only three things you have to master. You know, and there, everything else is a variation on these three things. That's how I break it down. The first big idea of the sexual revolution is the idea that a good and decent society should do everything possible to separate sex from babies. Okay, now think about that a minute. Are we not there? I mean, is that not our culture?
I love you. I mean, really summing up these obvious things, because when you give voice to them and put them in a sentence, in a formula, you can look at it and realize that is so off.
That is so stupid.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's stupid.
So we have to distinguish that which nature has received from God, has received from the, just the human experience, separate these things by our power, because you can't do it naturally.
Right.
Okay.
Do everything possible to separate sex from babies. Okay. And I call that the contraceptive ideology. Okay. And in the book, with each one of these three ideologies, I go through explaining what it is and then explaining where it came from and then explaining the massive amount of propaganda that you have to come up with to keep people believing this thing. So the longest chapter in the book, I'm pretty sure the longest chapter in the book, is the propaganda surrounding the contraceptive ideology. And that's where I talk about eugenics people, you know, and how far back it goes and stuff like that. You know, that's where that is in the book. And that book is a few years old by now.
It's phenomenal.
I know more now than I did when I wrote it. Because
things have gotten even worse.
Because, but anyway, so that's the first big idea, that a good society should separate sex from babies, contraceptive ideology. Second big idea, a good and decent society should do everything possible to separate both sex and babies from marriage. Okay, so now think about, are we not there?
Right? Oh, yeah. Oh,
We're totally there.
Yeah.
I call that the divorce ideology. And here's why I call it the divorce ideology. The basic idea here is that you don't need to be married in order to have sex. You don't need to be married in order to have babies. Underlying that is the belief or the hope or the superstition, I'm not sure exactly what you want to call it, but the untruth, okay? I say children need their parents. Children need their mother and father, and marriage delivers the goods to the children, okay?
100%.
So the whole divorce ideology is based on the idea kids don't really need their parents. They're resilient. Kids are resilient.
Yeah.
They'll be fine. It's worse for them if you're quarreling.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what we're dealing with here.
And this is literally hurting the ears of some people who are listening right now. That the hateful speech that a kid needs mom and dad.
Yeah.
That if a couple, you know, explodes in some way that requires separation, maybe there's a situation where someone's in danger, whatever it is, that's radically different. But even then, the kids are going to suffer and need serious help. Like, you can't escape that painful reality. And it's not hateful to say it. It's cruel to children to not recognize it.
Yeah.
You know, and that idea that sex is connected with babies, that families are better for children.
Yeah.
Saying the obvious.
Yeah.
We're not only making permission for people to think the opposite. We've relabeled those things as standing in the way of human flourishing.
Yes, yes.
That's that's what makes it a revolution, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Revolution's not peaceful.
It's at war with human nature. The whole sexual revolution is at war with human nature. It's at war with reality. And the fact that you and I are going, oh gosh, we're not allowed to say that, right?
You want
to
whisper that.
We know but we're not allowed to say that. That's part of the propaganda machine that has been part of the sexual revolution also from the beginning. Because it takes a lot of convincing to convince people that they don't that their kids don't really need that. You know what I mean? 100%. I mean, this is the most natural thing in the world. So, and I think when people hear my talks and stuff like that, or they encounter me for the first time, some of the feedback that I get back from people is, I feel so relieved to know that I'm not the only person who thinks that the stuff I'm hearing from the world is crazy.
Right.
You know, and you realize how much it's out there, just how thoroughgoing it is. But back to the main idea of the divorce ideology, it's not just divorce. It's also unmarried parenthood. When the Ruth Institute talks about the divorce ideology, we talk about anything that separates a child from their parents because of the decisions of adults. So there are some unavoidable tragedies in this life, and you have to have provision for those, of course.
Yeah.
You know, somebody dies, somebody's mentally ill, there's serious violence, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. You have to have some provision for the unavoidable tragedies, right? But anything that separates a child from a parent, other than that, we include as part of the divorce ideology. Mm. So that includes not just divorce, but also unmarried parenthood, and also the whole issue of third-party reproduction and the use of IVF and surrogates and purchasing sperm, purchasing eggs, renting a womb, all of that that is separating a child from a parent from the beginning of their lives by intention.
Wow.
You know, and so, yeah, we're all over that. We talk about that.
And then the third...
The third ideology. Yeah. The third ideology I call the gender ideology. And this is the idea that the sex of the body is not particularly important. And we can redefine it. We can say that it's all socially constructed. Any differences between men and women are socially constructed and evidence of injustice. That's the beginning phase of it. That's modern feminism. Mm. But that has morphed into the claim that marriage has nothing to do with the sex of the body. So you can have two men, you can have two women, you can have a man and a woman, and it's really all the same thing. Hmm. And legally, it's all the same thing. And so therefore, in reality, it's in every relevant reality, it's all the same thing, you know? And then finally, it's morphed into what we now think of as transgenderism.
Yep, yep.
But the whole idea, the thing that unifies those things, because there's a lot of self-contradiction within this idea, the gender ideology, what unifies the contradictions is the idea that the sex of the body is not particularly significant.
Hmm.
And we can overwrite it if we want to. Hmm. And if we have a good reason, if we have a good enough reason, we can overwrite the importance of the sex of the body.
These things are so fundamental that it's really hard to you know, go across the barrier and have a conversation with people who disagree. Because those views are indicative of an entirely different, you know, posture toward reality. That is reality something I find myself within and receive, or is it something that's completely fluid that I can just craft for myself? I mean, it feels a little unfixable sometimes. Well, I guess apart from just total conversion and finding God, because if someone has that atheistic worldview, then all the things that follow that you just articulated kind of makes sense. Because why not? If I'm self-aware space sludge, why not? Right?
Say that again. That's quite a phrase.
Yeah.
Self-aware
space sludge. I mean, that's what the atheistic worldview would conclude about a human being. That's all I am.
I heard somebody else use the phrase meat Legos.
That's
good. Can just take them apart and put them back together however you want and stuff like that. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, another thing for your audience to think about is that I've heard somebody say this too, and I didn't make this up, but I don't know who originally said it. The first millennium of Christianity, the big question was, who is Jesus? Hmm. Who is Jesus? Second millennium of Christianity is, what is the church?
Hmm.
The third millennium of Christianity, what is a person?
Dang.
Who are we?
Boy, that's perfectly said.
Isn't that? I didn't make that up. Whoever made it up, thank you.
We look back 1,000 years ago. There's metaphysical debates about the nature of Christ, or and all these beautiful metaphysics. They're going to look back 1,000 years and say, "You guys were fighting about what?"
Right.
the most brilliant minds of your time had to think
about
what?
This. It's true.
That's amazing.
It's true.
I want to cut to the premise of your book.
Oh, yeah, okay. Wait, there was something I was going to tell
you. Oh, yeah, sorry, I don't cut you off.
Eugenics. You wanted to go back to the eugenics
thing. I want to take that thread, and let's go back to that.
Yeah, okay.
But all this stuff is so counter to human nature. Like, if you leave people alone, they're going to figure out what we now call traditional views about marriage and sex. You go to the middle of the jungle, there's something that looks remotely like marriage. There's a ritual around it. Society protects it, you know, because it just comes from what we are. So therefore, in order to enforce these ideas, this can't be grassroots. It's got to come top down. It's got to take a heavy-handed state. I don't know if you read Roger Ayer's book, Live Not by Lies.
I'm familiar with it. Yeah.
He talked about people who, he interviewed people who survived communism, and he said, you know, just before the Iron Curtain fell, things we talked about openly, we started to whisper about in coffee shops because we were afraid.
Yeah.
Like, this conversation's loud right now. If I was at a coffee shop with you and we're talking about how all this stuff is crazy, we'd probably lower our tone a little. There's an oppressive vibe.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the average person. You list a bunch of things that are being pushed by radical fundamentalist sexual revolutionaries, right? That are now mainstream somehow. And you ask the question, you cut through the garbage. Can any honest person believe that any of these things happened because masses of ordinary people wanted them to happen? That their kids might be taken away from them. There's people fighting in Colorado right now.
Oh.
Right? That if I misgender my own child, that the state might take that child away. Like, there's no average, even people who disagree with us about this stuff are not pushing for that.
Right.
Unless they're total radicals. So this is where the conspiracy theory, literal conspiracy theory, proves to be true.
Mm-hmm.
Unmask the sexual state for us. What do you mean by that? Is there literally organized bodies of people? What is there a shadow government sexual state? What's happening here to us all?
Okay, so at one level, I don't know. Okay, I'm just going to flat out tell you. I can't name names. I don't have the receipts. Okay, I mean, you know, in one sense, but the transgender issue I think is very instructive for people to see because it happened. It appeared to happen so quickly. I think all honest people can see that came from the top down.
100%.
That there is literally no grassroots demand for boys and girls bathrooms or boys and girls track teams and none, zero, zip, nada. Yeah. The earlier phases of the sexual revolution took longer, and so the propaganda machine was at work for a longer period of time, and people sort of got more used to it, and so it wasn't as obvious.
Yeah.
But it all, you know, throughout the book, I really explain how that, in each case, how that came about, you know? So with the transgender issue, we can see now that there are people who are literally making money off of it.
Wow.
You know, there are people within the medical establishment who are making money.
Yeah.
There's no question about that. The pharmaceutical industry making money, you know. There are people who have fantasies of, oh, by the way, y'all, I hate to break this to you, but the end game of transgenderism, there are two parts to it, really, but one of the end games of transgenderism is transhumanism. Mm. You know, so there are some rich people who are out there who are really, you know, in my opinion, out there mentally, who have the idea of uploading their consciousness into some kind of computer or something and continuing their existence. And those people, I think, do see transgenderism as the gateway to people accepting the idea of man-machine, man-computer combination, you know. So that's part of what's going on.
Yeah, the
there.
Speed of the change indicates top down, but the transgender thing. I remember after, 2015 and gay marriage became the law of the land. No one was thinking that the next thing would be this.
No normal person. But this is a very interesting thing that I did not know when I wrote the book. But this, in different people that I've interviewed since then. Gay marriage was, the Obergefell decision was on the 26th of June, 2015. So you guys can look this up. Here I do have receipts.
Yeah.
The very same weekend, the issue of Vanity Fair came out that had Bruce Jenner on the cover dressed as Caitlyn.
The same weekend.
Same weekend.
Yeah.
2 weeks later, I Am Jazz, the Jazz Jennings reality TV show, had its first episode.
Wow.
Okay, so you, number one, you can't tell me that that's coincidence.
No.
That's not coincidence. You can't tell me that they didn't know how the court was going to rule. Yeah. Okay, I mean, so who are all these people? I don't know who all these people are. But you look around and you go, you know, there were somebody's working together. Yeah. This didn't just pop up out of nowhere. You know?
And then the quick relabeling of anyone who stands in the way as being hateful and bigoted.
Right, right.
And it's like, whoa, hold on. You read the stats of unhappiness, suicide, everything. And also, those apply in San Francisco where it's widely accepted, right? And why are we encouraging, therefore, kids to consider this as an option? 1 in 20 kids now at public school don't know their gender.
Yeah, yeah.
1 in 20.
Yeah, there's.
That's not just treating people with compassion who have a gender dysphoria. That's become public.
Right.
Promotion of something.
Right.
That can hurt people and confuse them. But you're the hateful bigot. Like overnight.
No, child, that didn't happen overnight. That was all. Huh. All these techniques were being worked on back in the whole gay marriage debate. Okay, because I was there from the beginning, not really the beginning, from its first sort of big public appearance. I was a campaign spokeswoman for Proposition 8 in 2008 in San Diego. I got involved in the campaign. By that time, I had already written 2 books on marriage and family, and I already understood kids need their parents. I had not given 5 minutes of thought to gay marriage before it came on the ballot and so on and so forth. And literally, this is a God thing, I think. I founded the Ruth Institute. I marked the date of founding the Ruth Institute with the day I had a first employee. So August 1st, 2008,
nice.
I had a nice girl, you know, a recent graduate from Gonzaga, you know, come down and help me be my admin. And we were going to, you know, get this thing off the ground. And literally, I got signed up to be a campaign spokeswoman for Prop 8. Right around that time, the very first thing that she and I did was to drive up to Los Angeles to speak to the LA Times editorial board on behalf of Prop 8. So it happened very quick from my perspective.
Yeah.
But the reason I got involved is that even though I hadn't thought very much about gay marriage, and I certainly was not interested in homosexual issues at all, the reason I got involved is I could see that this was going to be a threat to children having their own parents. I could see that this was going to, because two men are not, obviously not the parents of the child. They're obviously not, right? One of them might be, but no, you know. Some parent, there's a lost parent out there somewhere, and I hadn't thought it through. Actually, that's where this book came from, is in the process of me debating gay marriage for years and years, you know, and following that whole issue. You know, and just coming up, trying to come up with one more argument and one more, you know, responding to this or that or the third thing, you know, because the stuff is popping all the time. That's how I developed this three-part analysis.
Wow.
But where was I going with this? Very early on, they were calling us names in the whole Prop 8 thing. Most people weren't involved in the Prop 8 thing the way I was, right? So you didn't get to see that. We became listed on the Southern Poverty Law Center's hate list in 2013.
Yeah.
And we're still on their hate list.
Wow.
Okay.
Clearly, you are a hateful person. I could tell by just looking at you right now. Dangerous.
Anyone can see that.
Man. It's crazy.
When are you going to get on the list, man? Come on.
Probably after this show.
You got to up your game, dude.
I know.
Come
it's
on.
It's crazy.
You're leaving an old lady
out? How do you answer people when they say your entire motive is hatred? Just bigotry. You're just trying to limit people's freedom.
I just don't. I most of the time now, I don't take it seriously.
Yeah.
In the sense that generally that happens when they're trying to change the subject.
Hmm.
So generally what I'll try to do in one way, you can see, do you ever read the National Catholic Register? I often have columns in there.
You do.
And people will yell at me and then comments and stuff. And so I'll come back and say, I'll go back to the main point of the article, whatever it was, right?
Yeah.
So if the issue becomes me and how mean I am, that means they don't want to talk about the main subject. So I said, wait a minute, let's go back to the main subject. You couldn't think anything you want about me. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
But Could we please go back to the subject at hand? But that's what people need to see. This is a diversionary tactic, okay? The sexual revolutionaries, in fact, only have one tactic. Divert, divert, and divert some more. Mm. Because if you look at the issues like you just did, you know, you were sitting there with your mind blown, right?
Yeah.
They can't let you do that. So they got to change the subject, you know? And that's true for their life issues. That's true for the marriage issue. It's true for all of it. So y'all listening, watching, you know, have that in mind the next time somebody starts, you know, see if you can get back to the subject.
See if you can get back to the
main subject. And so don't dignify this with a response.
Yeah.
You know, at some point, that's what you learn to do. It's 100%. You know, I'm not taking the bait.
Yeah.
You know, you're trying to bait me. I know.
And it's so gaslighty.
Yeah.
Really. Like the person who's pushing an agenda on kids that is statistically proven to hurt them is the one who loves and is helping them become free.
That's right. Yeah. Anyway, where were we going? We have tight.
We have a lot of threads.
So
I love these threads.
Little rabbit trails.
The sexual states really, it's a little hard to dig into and see who's behind things here. When you go overseas, you realize the power of what happens here in America, in underdeveloped nations. I had the honor of preaching throughout the Philippines years ago. When I was there, there were protests, and I was given this, like, it was organized by a big chastity group, and there was 15,000 people at this event. It was amazing. But there were protesters who had these big signs that we want condoms. And the people I was with went up and asked them, do you know what your sign says? And they said, I have no idea. They couldn't read English. A lot of the people, and they said, we were just given some, you know, Filipino pesos because we need some food today, and I'm here with the sign. That was it. Literally funding propaganda in the Philippines, and at the same time, the U.S. government was saying, we're going to give you foreign aid and food if you make condoms more widely available. This is the ideological colonization Pope Francis talked
100%.
About. Hey there, I just want to share something really important with you guys real quick. You know what's crazy? This entire show, every episode, every conversation, every life changed only happens because of our supporters. The Chris Stefanik Show is powered by people like you, people who believe in spreading the joy of the gospel. Now here's the deal. Each year we reach millions of people, but there are millions more that have not received not just the good, but the great news of the gospel. We want to reach those people, walk with them, and that's where you come in. When you become a monthly donor, a missionary of joy, you're not just donating. You're actually making this mission possible. You're helping us bring the hope, truth, and joy of the gospel to a world that desperately needs it. And that's not all. As a missionary of joy, you get exclusive access to all our video series, including Living Joy, Rise, Renewed, Fearless, and more. You get exclusive early access to new releases. You get Monday motivation texts direct from me. And you get access to our daily anchor, daily inspiration to fuel your faith. The truth is, the gospel is too good to keep to ourselves. If this show or our work has encouraged you, challenged you, or strengthened your faith, imagine how many more lives we can change together. Don't just watch the mission, fuel it. Click the link below and become a monthly donor today. It'll be the best investment you make this year.
Right? 100%.
And the things they blame missionaries for, you know, oh, you're just tying the gospel to food. Actually, we don't. We don't, don't.
And you?
But the sexual revolution does.
Totally, yeah. Totally.
Where else are we seeing this globally? I don't know if you've uncovered that stuff.
Listen, just recently, I'm sure your shows have a long life, so people might be watching this show 5 years from now.
Yeah, when things are even worse.
Well,
when we're in jail together, it's going to be great.
But the reason I'm saying that is that literally within the first weeks of the Trump administration, they went in and looked at USAID, and they had some inside. You know, they were prepared because they looked at USAID and realized that there was a lot of corruption in USAID. And so they went and shut that down. And, you know, that whatever worthwhile programs are in there by now have been revived. But they shut it. They just went, boom, it's all got to go. Yeah. Because it was this type of thing, one thing after another, this type of.
Rattle off some of the things they uncovered.
On that most recent list, you know, there was, you know, comic books promoting transgenderism and operas promoting transgenderism and, you know, different things promoting in some way or another the gender ideology. But you mentioned the Philippines. The Filipino people resisted the United Nations and all these international agencies. They resisted them for at least 20 years, Chris, you know, with them breathing down their necks constantly, you know. And the Philippines, for the record, is like 95% Catholic or something like that. They had good laws. And the international so-called community, the international bullies, basically, you know, were there saying, we want you to change your laws, money contingent on this, money contingent on that, so on and so forth. And still the Filipino people did not go along with it. You know, it took a long time to break it down. I received a call from a podcaster in the Philippines saying, Dr. Morse, they're trying to undo our divorce laws. Wow. Can you help us?
Since it's worked so well for us, we should tell the Filipinos what to do.
I know.
Since we're all so happy here.
I know. I know. And so I did a show, you know, I was on his podcast and he was on my podcast, you know, and but interestingly enough, what I learned from him is that the Filipino divorce law, the rule they had at that time, and I don't know what it is now, but they were trying to go for modern no-fault divorce like we have in the U.S.
Just back out easy, no consequence.
Yeah, right.
Takes 5 minutes.
But what they had at that time, what this guy told me, people could get divorced, you could get divorced for cause, but the right to remarry did not automatically flow from having a divorce. Oh. So in order to get married again, you would have to go through a Catholic annulment.
Wow.
Okay. So what that means is that some of the most insidious aspects of our system over here were blocked by that. Yeah. If you were getting beat up by your husband, yeah, you could leave, and yeah, you could get divorced, but it was not an open and shut case that either of you'd be able to remarry. The fact that it's an open and shut case that you can remarry for any reason, right, that changes the incentives for everybody. This is where my economics training comes in, okay? Because in economics, one thing we know, people respond to incentives, right? And so if you're the first to the courthouse with the divorce papers, and that's advantageous for you, and you have a new sweetie waiting in the wings,
right?
You know, it changes all the incentives, you know. So,
and the data is so easily
it's so
available.
Clear. It's so clear,
right? Chris. And you look at like making divorce as easy as we have done. You look at the impact. You could track the impact, and to say, well, we have to export that to the Philippines. We know better. There's an insanity. It's like a radical fundamentalism. It's got a religious fervor to it, right? Like if you have a really weak set of beliefs and someone pokes that bear, well then the response is to be unreasonable, to attack the person, to get violent. It's the same thing with some of these sexual revolution premises,
so,
isn't it?
Here's how I would express that. It occupies the same space in your psyche that religion should be. So in other words, people want to say it's like a religion to them. And if you see it as an analogy, fine. But it's not a religion. It's occupying the same mental and spiritual space that should be occupied by Jesus Christ, because that's the only true religion, right? And they have all the fervor of it and, you know, all the problems that you would see with none of the constraints that Jesus gave us these constraints for our benefit, for our good. You know what? There is one more thing I want to say about about the divorce ideology. Because of something you said. So I have these three ideologies, contraceptive, divorce, gender ideology. Yeah. Okay. Most people around the world have figured out that sex makes babies, as you pointed out. And most societies have some provision, for making sure the kids are taken care of.
Yeah.
Most societies around the world have worked out that men and women are different and have some provision for dealing with that in a reasonable manner. Divorce, that's not so obvious. This is the unique Christian contribution to civilization. When Jesus said, one to a customer for life. Wait, no, he didn't put it quite like that. But no, that's what it was. But that's what it was. In Matthew 19, when he says, no divorce, Mark 10, you know, Mark chapter 10, no divorce.
That was radical.
It was radical. The apostles were freaked out, okay? Remember?
Isn't that
amazing? They were like, you got to be kidding. No, yeah. I'm not kidding. Let's talk about, what was the next thing he talked about?
I don't have it in my head.
Celibacy.
Yeah, there you
celibacy.
Go. Yeah, let's up it more. Let's make it even harder.
Right. So the idea of lifelong monogamy being normative for a society, that is the unique Christian contribution to society. And some people have argued, very intelligent people have argued, that this is the key to the West's growth, is that the sexual energy, the sexual drive, is channeled in the most constructive way possible. And if you think about it, lifelong monogamy means for every child a mother and a father. For every child, no matter how poor, no matter how rich, every child gets their own mother and father.
Yeah.
That's not what we have today. Kids having their mother and father, that's for rich people.
Dang.
Poor people don't have that, okay? Jesus, this is what Jesus wanted us to have. The other thing it means is that you don't have polygamy, you don't have serial polygamy, you don't have ongoing polygamy. For every man, no matter how rich, one and only one wife.
Even if he wants lots of them.
Even if he wants lots of them. And polygamous societies have a lot of problems. You know, and I would defy anybody. Open the Old Testament, please. Look at the cases of polygamous families. Tell me one of those families that you would like to be part of.
Right.
No. I don't think so.
Totally.
You know, the jealousy between the wives.
Yeah.
You know, the jealousy between the brothers. Get everybody, all the brothers mad at Joseph because he was the child of his father's old age and the wife that he's really loved, that Jacob really loved. You know, well, we're recreating all of that.
Yeah, these cultural norms are... They could be helpful. And just because people can find examples of cultural norms being used to be cruel to people who didn't fit them or who failed or who ended up experiencing brokenness doesn't undo the fact that we should have cultural norms. These are literally the yellow lines in the road that help people and help society. I want to keep poking the bear a little more. I want to go through just some more fruits of the sexual revolution.
Okay.
Maybe you can unmask the lies behind it and the impact of each of these.
Yeah.
And the first, I remember literally learning this as a public school kid, seeing the graphs of the globe that was just too full of people, and there were people falling off into outer space. You know, I'm probably in fifth grade seeing some of these things, and we have to watch global population. And this was one of the lies used to mandate the sexual revolution. You're an economist. You have some serious insights about this that most people don't have. And some people who are watching or still believe the overpopulation myth.
Yeah.
Is this a problem?
Yeah.
Drive across Utah. You'll see it's not a problem. But it's like most of the world is kind of empty. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. I'm really glad you brought this up because the myth of overpopulation is what kind of underwrote a lot of this stuff. And literally billions of dollars have been spent to convince people that the world is overpopulated and to convince people that we need abortion, that we need contraception, you know. You could not imagine the sexual revolution without people like Bill Gates. Well, Bill Gates is a latecomer, but John D. Rockefeller III is the guy who really first said overpopulation. Mm. He used to put Rockefeller money into all sorts of things, you know, including, by the way, going to Notre Dame to try to convince people at Notre Dame that something must be done about the population. You know, he had little meetings at Notre Dame prior to Humana Vitae being decided. He was over there, you know, being a weasel, in my opinion, you know, just using his money, sprinkling a little money around, you know. But the idea that the world is overpopulated has never been sound scientifically. I had a dear friend named Julian Simon who famously debated Paul Ehrlich on this matter, and Julian just crushed him all the time. And they had a bet. Julian Simon said, if we're really running out of resources, then it should be the case that natural resources would become more expensive over time because they're becoming more scarce. So I'll bet you, Paul Ehrlich, you pick any 10 commodities that you want, tin, lead, you know, tin, whatever. I forget. Well, I know Tim was on the list. tungsten, anything you want. You pick the 10 commodities, and I'll bet you that those 10 will get cheaper in 10 years. Wow. And you're betting they'll get more expensive in 10 years. Wow. And in the end, Paul Ehrlich had to pay Julian Simon.
Wow.
Okay, so, you know, and as an economist, if somebody says there are too many people, too many compared to what? What's the criteria? They never tell you what the criteria is. See?
Yeah.
And that's why you come up with this contradiction of people saying global warming and net carbon zero and all this stuff, and they're flying to Davos in private jets.
Right, right.
Because they don't really mean it. You know, in some way, they don't really mean it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, no, and now anyone with a nickel's worth of sense in demography is aware that the big problem is underpopulation, declining population, population collapse. There has never been population decline on the scale that we're having now. Huh. That it's going to happen. Whole populations are going to disappear.
So what happens? What happens when populations decrease in size?
Well, first of all, you can't take
care. Don't we have more national parks? Isn't that a good thing?
Yeah, you can't take care of your stuff. You can't take care of your infrastructure. Now, the Germans, being very neat and tidy, have been going around demolishing abandoned buildings.
Wow.
Now, we have abandoned buildings around here, you know.
Yeah.
So as their population's declining, you don't need as many houses. Well, some people will just leave it sit there.
Just cover the space in chrome.
Yeah. So it's not. So you can't take care of your stuff.
Yeah.
And so the physical, you know, the physical stuff, a lot of it's going to go away. Your ability to have a sustained, modern technological society, you got to have people to run all that. You got to have people to maintain it.
Yeah.
You can't replace everything with robots. See, this is the fantasy. Robots will do it. You know, no, they're not going to do it all.
Right.
AI, it's not going to do it all. It can't do it all, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and the biggest one, the most morally obtuse, obtuse is not the word I'm looking for.
It's a good one. We'll go with it.
The most morally problematic.
Yeah.
Countries are not going to be able to meet their obligations to the elderly.
Yeah.
Okay, so Social Security worked fine when you had a growing population.
Mm.
When you have a declining population, that means you have fewer taxpayers, less money to pay to take care of an increasing percentage of the population that is old and needs care. You know, so what they're going to do...
Euthanasia?
You know,
get more
of
popular.
Course, they're going to euthanize people. You know, of course, that's what they're... You know, that's what they're going to do, you know. But some of us, you know, could look down the road. Demography is actually a pretty easy science. I can tell you right now, 40 years, how many 40-year-olds there will be in 40 years.
Wow.
Because you know how many babies there are.
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
There can't be any more
how
than that.
How many people
are
working and providing for everything? That goes down, we got a problem.
Yeah, that goes down. You had a problem.
I've even heard this in you know, Catholic settings and being taught in religious curriculums along the lines of social justice and how the world has X amount of resources and Americans consume a disproportionate amount of those resources. And it's that scarcity mentality with the resources, and it's simply not true.
Correct.
It's
correct.
It
wasn't true when Thomas Malthus said it in the 1700s. It is not true today for a whole bunch of reasons. It's not true.
What underdeveloped nations often lack is the freedom and justice to use their resources and have them distributed fairly.
Right.
But that's the problem.
Right, right.
Not that I'm taking it because I had a sandwich from some, you know, of course you got to donate to the poor, but that's a different issue.
Right, but the way it's presented to us is that there are only so many resources in the world and we're using them up, and so they'll all go away if we keep going the way we're going. What that doesn't take into account is we're not going to keep going the way we're going in every single dimension. People come up with new technologies. People, different societies are organized differently. That's what you're referring to, right? That it's not as easy to create wealth in some environments. It's not as easy to extract resources and use them productively, in some environments than in others. And so an economist would always want to know, no, I don't accept that there's only so much. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You know, that's not a complete question.
By all means, recycle and don't leave your water on all day. But, you know, this is different category.
Exactly.
Being wasteful.
And you know something? You don't need to slavishly recycle. If the amount of energy it takes to recycle is not cost effective, then you shouldn't be doing that.
Or if recycling causes more pollution, which can actually happen sometimes.
Yes, it
can. But we're not allowed to ask these questions without...
That's right.
Anyway, we didn't ask them, though.
Yeah,
we didn't ask them.
Right? Yeah.
So,
here's what I want to point out. Okay. Yeah. With the sexual revolution, you can think of it as an ideology that has an impossible mission and therefore opens the goal, you know, opens the field for a predatory government, tyrannical government, you know, to say, okay, give us everything so that we can do this impossible thing, okay? The whole environmental movement has become an ideology in the very same kind of sense. Mm. There are plenty of people who are conservationists. There are plenty of ex-Green members, right, who have left that movement because it was like, you know, no, this isn't what we had in mind. But if you're going to say we're going to save the Earth, and we're not going to be too specific about what's included in that,
right? And what do
then,
you mean?
Then you're opening the thing up for a kind of ideological tyranny in the same way. And the climate change movement is this. I'm not as well informed about that, so I don't want to talk about it too much. But structurally, it's the same. Do you see
it can all be used that way.
It can be used in this manner. That's right.
Let's pick up that thread we had, maybe 45 minutes ago. I have a good ADD brain, so I see all the topics at one time in front of us, right? But how contraception and birth control is married to eugenics at its core.
Yes.
I want to unmask that too.
Yes, and that's important because it is part of this conversation about too many people.
Yeah, not, a lot of people don't know, but it also reveals why there's a powerful state behind these things, because there's an agenda that the average guy was not aware of behind it all.
So the early eugenics movement is a Darwinist offshoot. You know, it's something that says, oh, the struggle of the fittest, the survival of the fittest. We're letting people live who are not really very fit. Why are we taking care of these people who can't take care of themselves? Mm. You know, there was, as a direct result of Darwinism, you know, a response by some people to say Christian charity is a bad thing for society because we've got all these people who can't take care of themselves. It's not fit, blah, blah, blah. So there's that little thread that kind of popped up very quickly after Darwin.
Yeah.
And then other people took the same kind of thought process and said, well, you know, we should be more thoughtful about who we allow to breed. You know, we should be intentional about who gets to reproduce and stuff like that. And so that group of people, some of them were related to Darwin, you know, like some of his relatives and stuff. And by the early 20th century, there were a number of people, both in the UK and in the United States, who really, you know, were thinking in terms of, you know, we need to do something about the gene pool, you know, and this is the way they would think of it. And the early idea was not so much abortion. You know, abortion was not a thing for until quite a little bit later, but we should be encouraging intelligent people to have kids. That was one phase of it. And then we should be sterilizing people who were unfit. Mm. And so this is where we, in the United States, there were a number of states that had eugenics laws that basically said in punishment for crimes or certain other situations, the state would have the right to forcibly sterilize somebody.
Wow.
And there's a very famous Supreme Court case called Buck versus Bell where the United States Supreme Court upheld those laws, you know.
Wow.
And in fact, this is the one where Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes was heard to said in print, three generations of imbeciles are enough.
Wow.
Okay? So that was early eugenics. And that, by the way, Buck versus Bell, as far as I know, is still law.
Wow.
I don't think it's ever been overwritten by anything else. So there's that whole phase of it. Then the birth control idea comes along as a way of controlling the fertility of the poor, and this is where Margaret Sanger is really a very important figure.
Yeah,
it cannot be denied that this was her motivation. You know, that this was part of what was important.
She was a total racist.
She was a racist. She was a classist. You could say that she was against poor people. And she had multiple lovers during the course of her life. There's no question in my mind that she wanted to be able to have sex without being married. You know, that was the sort of never explicitly stated motive, but it's in the, how can we put it? It's kind of in the background of a lot of these debates. Some of the people who want this stuff, who are promoting this stuff,
yeah.
You can sort of read between the lines
and personal motives.
And get that that's...
Oh, yeah.
And by the way, this is what makes the whole idea of sex outside of marriage becoming plausible, because mentally they're sterilizing it. You know, if it's really sterile, you can do whatever you want kind of thing.
Yep.
So that's part of the story. So now... Where did we leave off? Yeah, so Margaret Sanger is promoting the legalization of birth control, birth control methods. In her day, there was no pill, right? There was no birth control pill. You know, you're looking at things like condoms and different things like that. And in some states, you couldn't purchase those things, or you could only obtain them from a doctor. So a married woman could perhaps obtain them from a doctor, and the doctor wouldn't get in trouble. But it wasn't being advertised. It wasn't, there weren't freestanding birth control clinics.
Yep.
Okay. That's the beginning.
Yeah, and the popularization of all this, especially even today, you drive through poorer neighborhoods or you're in an inner city somewhere, there's a disproportionate amount of Planned Parenthoods in an all black community in a city somewhere than other places. I mean, it's still, you were talking about systemic injustice. It's still expressing itself. The origins of why this became so popular so fast. It wasn't just because people demanded it. It's because it was being pushed.
Yes. Right? Yes, it's being pushed. And some people are benefiting from it. I want to pick up one further thread here. And that is, it became part of U.S. foreign policy at some point.
Yeah.
Henry Kissinger, it was under Kissinger and Nixon who first introduced population as a policy, that the United States should have a population policy. There was never a population policy by Eisenhower or anybody like that. And their reason was that they had the idea that if poor countries have too many kids, if people in poor countries have a lot of kids, they will be more poor, they will stay poor, and they will be ripe for communist takeover.
Wow.
That was the thought process.
Wow. Wow. It's amazing.
I know.
Yeah, and again, we have this idea: less kids will liberate us, make life easier. We're the frog in the boiling water. You know, again, go back to the Philippines when I was there, and these are new concepts for this culture: ideological colonization. The people's responses was like, you literally just threw a bunch of boiling water on them. Like, the response was like, wait, I'm poor, so therefore you want me to have less kids? My kids are my retirement plan. My kids are my wealth.
Right.
My kids are my security.
Right.
My kids are. This gives life meaning: is the fact that I have family.
Right.
And America's saying, no, you will be happier with one child.
Right, right.
Between the two of you. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Do you know what?
Sorry.
One more thing.
Yeah.
One more thing. Because
yeah,
I mentioned Rockefeller. There is a video that was a pro-population control video, a pro-contraception video, produced, I want to say, in the 60s. And it was produced in cooperation with the Population Council, which is Rockefeller's outfit. And it was produced by Walt Disney.
Oh, dang. Disney. Come on, man.
Walt
Come
Disney.
Back.
Donald Duck.
No.
You know, yeah. And, you know, in showing the people with a lot of children, they're poor and they're sad. And there's one little issue where the wife whispers to her husband. And then the narrator said, yes, it's perfectly okay. Because she was reticent, and she wanted to know if it was okay.
Yeah,
you know, and so I mean, it's propaganda.
Yeah,
I mean, there's no.
Yeah.
And so in some of my speeches where I have been talking about propaganda, I show, you know, go look at this film. Here's the link to it.
It's
go
crazy.
Look at it for yourself. You know, they've been working this turf for a long time.
Wow. Leave us with this. Maybe a couple. Actually, two more questions. Because I want to land on, just tell me anything else you want to tell me about your institute, which is doing phenomenal work.
Okay.
And punching way above your weight. Because it's not an aircraft carrier, but it's an F-16. An F-16 can do a lot of damage, right, in a good way, in this case. But before that, how do we, you know, as parents, as Christians, as just a regular guy, I can't compete with big government or with all these movements. How do I fight the sexual revolution?
Well,
what's my part?
The first part is that,
and I have a couple of thoughts I might add.
Yeah, I mean, I think really the biggest one is you have to make sure that you have dealt with whatever issues you have yourself. Mm. You're not going to be any help to anybody if you have lingering guilty conscience nagging at you at the back of your mind. I think the guilty conscience problem is a huge problem, you know, because people hold back from saying what needs to be said because they don't want to stir up their own. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
So the first thing I would recommend to everybody is, you know, make sure that you've dealt with your own stuff. You know, make sure that your spiritual life is intact. Yeah. Daily prayer, daily mass, daily rosary. Maybe you need a spiritual director, you know, but don't cut corners in that area. I just did that one thing.
Yep.
No. You know,
sin darkens the intellect, you know, right? We don't realize how much that's forming how we think.
Yeah, so that's the first thing. The second thing that I would say is you should really come and sign up at the Ruth Institute. We have a weekly newsletter that we put out. And at this point, when you sign up, we send you a free report that we did a few years ago. It's called Refuting the Top 5 Gay Myths. And a lot of the things that we're talking about here is in that, you know, I think it's like 30 pages or something like that. And it's got... You'll get it electronically so you can
We'll click. Link below the video.
Yeah, right? that'd be good. So you can click on the places where there are notes and stuff like that, you know, and go and be taken to the sources so you can see that, you know, that this is serious stuff. So inform yourself, you know, get your own spiritual house in order, inform yourself, and then, you know, seek other people who share your views and then try to support each other. So that when you do encounter somebody who's going through one of these things, that you are calm enough to deal with it. You know, I mean, parents ask me this all the time, you know, what do I say? My son just came out as gay or, you know, whatever it is. The first thing is try not to freak out.
Yeah.
Okay, try not to freak out. Try to ask open-ended questions. What do you mean by that when you tell me you're gay? What do you mean by that?
Yeah.
And then... That's an open-ended invitation to talk, Amen. You know, and to hear what they have to say. Amen. So those are things you can do at the personal level. At the more social level, the list is actually endless of what you can do because the sexual revolution has infiltrated every nook and cranny of society. So whatever your line of work is, whatever your profession may be, whatever skills and talents you may have, you can find something to do. One little shocking thing. One industry that has done a lot of mischief, or where mischief has been done, the insurance industry.
Really?
Insurance commissioners in their state make the rules about what gets covered by medical insurance and what doesn't get covered by
medical. Oh, wow.
And the bad guys have captured the insurance commissions. So if you're an insurance man...
There's a lot of money behind it, then.
If you're an insurance man, maybe there's some way you can use even that kind of very mundane... I mean, there's nothing mundane about any honest
work. Is there stuff on your website about how to get involved on the social level?
Some stuff, we have a whole page that's called a Parent Resource Center where we have a lot of different allied organizations listed. So, you know, if you need a lawyer or you need a therapist or that kind of thing. And then we have another page that's called Healing from the Sexual Revolution.
Oh, wow.
Where we've got different ministries that we've stumbled across, you know.
Beautiful.
People who minister to adult children of divorce, people who minister to those who have been through domestic violence, you know, this type of stuff. There's a whole list of them.
And what's the URL? Well, we'll link to it, but say it too for people just
listening. Oh, for the Ruth Institute. Yeah. Oh, ruthinstitute.org.
Beautiful.
Very simple.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Doctor, thank you.
Is that all?
Yeah.
Is that all?
Is there anything else you wanted to say about the Ruth Institute?
Well, I don't know. I thought you said you had two questions.
Actually, I wanted you to share more about what the Ruth Institute's doing, but you kind of into it. It's kind of covered it all in the one.
Okay.
Cool. I'm really grateful for you in large part because I think one of the reasons we're losing societally and have lost is because when someone is an agenda-driven fundamentalist on the side of the sexual revolution, they just have a lot of energy and time to put behind it.
Yeah.
And for the average normal dude, I'm going to say something that's just kind of commonsensical and normal right now, when you know that'll cost you your head, the tendency is, I'm just going to go on with my life because I'm not a fundamentalist, agenda-driven person. You know, it gives me a sigh, breathe a sigh of relief,
yeah,
knowing that you're out there fighting for us, and the work that you're doing, and that good, smart people like you are on our team, helping us to have a society that has social norms where people can thrive.
Right.
And not one where the norms are used to beat people over the head who aren't fitting or who are having a hard time and struggling, but where it becomes an easier thing to raise kids who, you know,
who feel loved.
Who feel loved, who aren't having to ask metaphysical questions about their identity, but they're just studying math at school, and, you know, and just where people can be, it's easier to be happy, frankly, for the average person. So I want to thank you for that, fighting that battle for us.
Well, I appreciate it very much, Chris. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and with all of your followers and viewers.
You're amazing.
Thanks.
And you guys are amazing. I love you. Thanks for watching. I want to especially thank you for watching if you have been fuming and angry and actually watching and listening to us the whole time. Leave comments below the video and we'll interact. I'll ask you to come and pop on and maybe leave some comments on the YouTube. If you want to go off on us, go ahead. We're here to listen and we'll respond. Listen, truth and love go together. That's what we see on the cross. There is a truth that doesn't compromise. That's the vertical beam of the cross. And there's a love that doesn't stop. That's the horizontal beam of the cross. That's what we're called to be as a church. That's what we're called to be for our kids. That's what we're called to be in society. Guys, never stop loving people who are experiencing growing up in the midst of the sexual revolution and they feel like a stinking mess or confused or they're making a lot of wrong choices. We're going to keep loving those people. We're not going to stop loving those people. We're also concurrently not going to stop doing one of the most important things that love demands of us, despite the fact that there are people even in church leadership who say being clear is unloving. No, 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 that's wrong. Love demands that we speak the truth. Not yell the truth, but just say it. Wherever you find yourself, with your kids, with people who are disagreeing with you, in your workplace, in the training you've been forced to go through at work, you, Christian, you stand up and keep speaking the truth. I think of the guy in the picture when the Nazis were all saluting. Like, we'll pull this picture up and show it on the screen, and there's one guy who's just standing there like this with his arms folded.
Mm-hmm.
Never go along with the crowd when it's going against the word of God and against what you know is right because of natural law and your conscience. Wham, this is a lot. We covered a lot of ground in this episode. I love you. Thanks for being with us.
It was a lot of fun.
Thank you, guys. We'll see you next time.